You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Pivot. My name is Arif Rafiq, and I'm your host. We're continuing with our series on the crisis in Israel and Palestine. In this episode, we're going to be taking a look at Saudi Arabia and how it's being impacted by the crisis and what role it could play in shaping the war's outcome and what follows. We're going to cover a lot of ground, from the fate of the Israeli-Saudi normalization process to relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia and the future of Saudi Arabia's de facto leader, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and his plans to transform the country. To help us unpack all this, we're joined by Christian Ulrichsen, a fellow at Rice University's Baker Institute. Christian is the author of a number of books on the politics of the Arab Gulf region. We've got links to those books in the show notes. Now, as is our practice, before I get to Christian, I just wanted to give an update on the human cost of this conflict. According to the Israeli government, over 1,400 civilians and military personnel were killed in the October 7th Hamas attacks. And at the time of the recording of this episode, the death toll in Gaza has surpassed 10,000. Roughly 75% of the population in Gaza has been displaced. The effects of the Israeli bombardment and ground invasion have been nothing short of catastrophic. And now to my interview with Christian Ulrichsen. So, Christian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, these attacks come at what is potentially a transformational moment in the Middle East. 2 weeks before the October 7th attacks, Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman told Fox News that, quote unquote, every day we get closer to a normalization deal with Israel. Now, given its wealth and religious leadership in the Arab and Muslim world, normalization would probably be a big deal, setting a precedent for much of the remainder of the Arab and Muslim world. So I'd like to get your sense of how close the Saudis and the Israelis were to a deal, where things stand now, and what role, if you think, if any, that played in shaping Hamas's choice to attack Israel.
I would agree with you that were Saudi Arabia to normalize with Israel, it would be a game changer for much of the Arab, indeed the Islamic world, because of Saudi Arabia's position within that Arab and Islamic community. It would be a game changer in the way that the Abraham Accords of 2020 with UAE and Bahrain and Morocco, potentially with Sudan, it was never quite clear, were not. Back then, very few countries followed. And in fact, the Saudi Arabian Arab Peace Initiative, which was unveiled back in 2002 by then Crown Prince Abdullah, remains almost a default region-wide position, normalization in exchange for withdrawal from occupied territory. So were the Saudis almost unilaterally, in this case, to go in a different direction and to make their own deal with Israel, I think they would take a lot of other regional states with them in a way we didn't see 3 years ago. So it would be huge. And I think that's why we saw certainly very key senior figures in the Biden administration putting so much time and effort and energy into trying to reach that deal. It was always unclear to me how close they got. Obviously, Mohammed bin Salman, in his interview with Fox News on, I think, September 20th, gave it a seal of royal approval by saying that they were getting closer every day. And he also said that a deal, if it happened, would be the biggest event in world politics since the end of the Cold War. So he was obviously setting the stage, I think, for a major breakthrough. We saw a series of media leaks, or at least leaks to the media, in September and even early October, the last being the day before, October 7th, that outlined apparent parts of this deal involving nuclear, Saudi's civil nuclear program that they would like to develop, and apparent concessions on enrichment of uranium. We saw the administration in D.C. entertaining the idea of a defense treaty of some sort, which would require a Senate ratification. And we saw at least signs that the administration was willing to actually try and secure that ratification. And we even saw signs of discussions on oil prices and output. Now, we've seen, obviously, a lot coming from the US side. We didn't see very much coming from the Saudi side, other than a very interesting op-ed written on October the 4th, so 3 days before October 7th, by the editor-in-chief of Arab News, the Saudi English-language newspaper, in which Faisal Abbas, the editor, did say that there was a team within the Saudi Foreign Ministry that had been working for several years with international partners to try and flesh out what the Palestinian component of a deal would be. And at least my understanding had been that before October 7th, the Palestinian component was the one issue on which there was still ground to be kind of resolved. It wasn't there yet. And clearly with what has happened since October 7th, that might be more difficult still. That might be the key sticking point, even if negotiations ever get back on track. And the Saudis announced on the 11th or the 12th of October that they had paused. So I don't think we were there yet. The fact, again, that the deal was being negotiated by Saudi, US, and Israeli officials gave no place to the Palestinians to actually represent themselves. And I think that is something that may have to obviously change going forward if an agreement is to be reached or revived in terms of negotiations. I don't think Hamas necessarily took their action on October 7th specifically to undermine or torpedo any deal. What they have done, of course, is probably torpedoed any movement towards a deal. I mean, that was one of the byproducts of what has happened. I don't think it was necessarily the motivating factor, but they would have been probably well aware that by acting in the way they did and by inviting what they must have known would be an overwhelming Israeli response would make it much more difficult for any Arab state that hadn't normalized to consider doing so, at least in the short term. I think it played into the thinking, even if it wasn't necessarily the main strategic or tactical point of calculus at that time.
Mm. So I want to zoom out a bit. MBS has a vision for Saudi Arabia's economic transformation. It's called Vision 2030. Much of that involves some high visibility, quote unquote, giga projects like the futuristic city of Neom. It's unclear as to whether many of them will actually ever even be realized. But sports and entertainment play a big role. Saudi Arabia is more or less mass importing soccer stars and looks almost certain to win the 2034 World Cup hosting rights. And even as this conflict has raged, Saudi Arabia has held a fashion week in Riyadh, the capital, as well as MBS's flagship annual economic forum. Jared Kushner, former President Trump's son-in-law, was one of the attendees. So there's clearly an attempt to create the image of normalcy. And indeed, maybe on the ground, there is some normalcy. But that also fits into what you've described in a recent article, that at least up until these attacks, Saudi Arabia has been trying to, quote unquote, de-risk itself from the region's threats. I'd like you to help our audience understand what exactly is Vision 2030, and what type of regional order MBS desires to achieve those domestic aims, and whether they're even possible.
Yes, well, Vision 2030 was launched in April 2016, when Mohammed bin Salman was still largely unknown, at least in the West. He had been appointed Deputy Crown Prince the year before. 1 year later, he would become Crown Prince. It was really part of his attempt, I think, to announce himself on the world stage, but also, in this case, on a Saudi domestic stage, as the man with a plan. This was his vision. It wasn't a plan, it was a vision, so more like a roadmap to try and transform the Saudi economy, move and diversify beyond oil. Of course, not the first time such a plan has been unveiled in any of the other Gulf states or even in Saudi Arabia itself, but it was quickly apparent, I think, that the plan, one of the key elements of the plan, was that there would be these huge giga projects like NEOM, for example, which was announced in at the very first Davos in the desert in October 2017, which is this futuristic city on the northwest coast of the Red Sea and northwest of Saudi Arabia. And there were other giga projects further down the Red Sea coastline in and around Riyadh and really across the country. And I think the challenge for Mohammed bin Salman is that we are now in 2023. We are now halfway between 2016 and 2030. It's unclear how much actual development has taken place. There is building at NEOM. Among the first buildings that were constructed were an airport and a series of royal palaces. And King Salman has spent quite a lot of time in NEOM, especially since the pandemic began in 2020. But the scale of what is being planned, the scale of some of these new cities and developments, is such that at least between now and 2030, so really just 7 years, 6 years left, the Saudis need to really move at breakneck speed to actually deliver the projects, and partly because expectations have been raised so high. And as part of that, they need stability. They can't afford to have missiles and drones raining down on Saudi cities, as was happening from Yemen pretty regularly up until the truce that was announced in 2022. That doesn't inspire investor confidence or confidence among all the potential visitors and residents who will populate these giga projects. The Saudi Ministry of the Saudi authorities just last month announced that they had revised upwards a plan of 100 million visits a year by 2030 to 150 million. And Mohammed bin Salman himself said at a TV interview in July with the Discovery Channel that he expected, he claimed that by 2030 the Saudi population would reach 50 million. Today it's 33 million, so he anticipates an additional 17 million people coming to live in Saudi Arabia by 2030. So the scale is absolutely enormous. For that to happen, they need to really work incredibly hard over the next 7 years, and they have to focus domestically. They cannot be distracted by anything that would put it all at risk, partly because Mohammed bin Salman has become so associated with Vision 2030 that if it falls short, if it's seen to be underwhelming, it would inevitably have an associational impact on him. There's also very fresh memories of the Formula One motor racing Grand Prix that took place in Jeddah in March 2022, which took place with a backdrop of black smoke billowing from a very nearby fuel depot, which had been struck by Houthi missiles fired from Yemen. So that doesn't give that image of stability of order. So for all these reasons, what we have seen over the past 12 months, or even longer, in fact, has been intent by the Saudi leadership to de-risk, to try and draw the sting of all the regional flashpoints that could have jeopardized that resolute focus they need. And that includes the decision in March this year to restore diplomatic relations with Iran, and brokered, of course, by the Chinese, and to try and make sure that whatever happens, nothing can derail the Vision 2030 progress. And it was deeply revealing that 5 days after October 7th, on the 12th of October, Mohammed bin Salman had his first conversation by telephone with Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi. I mean, they're very much, I think, trying to ensure that whatever happens in Israel and with Gaza is contained to that very kind of localized zone of conflict and does not assume regional aspects, because that would be absolutely catastrophic, at least in terms of the Saudi desire to move forward with Vision 2030 and to try to make sure that nothing gets in that way.
Yeah, and you'd mentioned Iran and that process of resuming diplomatic ties, and the fact that that kind of continues with, you know, the conversation between President Raisi and MBS. We also saw the Iranian foreign minister visit Riyadh on October 30th. So I'm wondering, how do we make sense of this continued high-level engagement? Is it something that we should be encouraged by? Does it indicate that both countries as entities are really keen on containing the fallout of the crisis? Or let's say when it comes to Iran, you know, there are other actors at play that may not necessarily be on board. Should we have confidence in the ability of both countries and the willingness of both countries to prevent an escalation in terms of their bilateral relations? Or are things more complicated on that front?
We're talking now 3.5 weeks into the war after October 7th. And so far, the signs have been that both the Saudis and I think the Iranians too very much do not want this to escalate. And that's a positive sign. It's a positive sign because, again, the fact that they are talking to each other. We've had these series of highest level conversations, and the Iranian foreign minister was also in Jeddah a week after the October 7th attacks to take part in a Organization of Islamic Conference meeting in Saudi Arabia. So there's high-level dialogue. There's a desire to at least keep each other informed, to try to prevent any miscalculation or misunderstanding or accidental trigger, especially with the situation on such a knife edge, especially in Israel and in the surrounding localities, especially with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And so far, we haven't seen any desire to escalate. And I would include in this the United Arab Emirates, because Dubai hosts Expo COP28 beginning on November 30th, and they do not want anything to derail that either. So the two most conventionally powerful Gulf actors, Israel and Saudi Arabia, and their erstwhile nemesis across the waterway, Iran, I think all have a shared interest in trying to maintain enough of a dialogue to ensure that we don't see an escalation. That said, there are so many points in Israel and with the Palestinians on both in Gaza and in the West Bank that could act as a trigger, and there's been so much anger, I think, polarization of views across the Middle East at what has been happening in Gaza, that a trigger could come out of nowhere and escalate. And I think just because of that concern, there is a desire to maintain open dialogue to ensure, at least to try and minimize the possibility of that happening.
Yeah, it's a very dynamic situation. And so that continued engagement and crisis management is obviously very necessary. I want to continue on those potential escalation risks. You know, the Saudis are obviously concerned about their southern border with Yemen. The Houthi rebels, who you had mentioned, or a separatist insurgency in Yemen, aligned with Iran. They've fired missiles at Israel. Some have been shot. They've been shot down by both Saudi Arabia as well as the United States. Now, when it comes to, let's say, potentially opening up another front in this war, how much of a threat is there of that from the Houthis to Israel as well as the Saudis? And how much are the Houthis controlled by Iran?
I think the greater threat comes from the Houthis trying to demonstrate to the people in Yemen that they are ruling, that they are in control over, that they are, I think they will feel the need to try and do something domestically for domestic purposes rather than being controlled by Iran. Don't forget that the Houthi raison d'etre, I mean, the very slogan that has, you know, the Houthis have repeated at every single rally since they really appeared in 2004 as then a small non-state actor in northwestern Yemen, has been death to America, death to Israel, death to the Jews. I mean, this has been their rallying cry ever since 2004. And obviously since 2014, for the last 9 years, The Houthis have been in control of large parts of the Yemeni state, not all of it, but large parts of it. They have, or at least they have ruled over a large segment of the Yemeni population, and they may feel, for their own reasons of domestic legitimacy, having put so much emphasis on taking the fight to Israel and to the Jewish people writ large, should they have to be seen to be doing something. And I think that's the potential risk, that the Houthis will escalate because they feel that they don't, then their grip over the Yemeni peoples that they are controlling may begin to be questioned. It could also be a Houthi tactic to try to almost force the Saudis to pick sides, and by sort of responding to any attack, they would be seen to be picking the side of Israel. So you can definitely see why, from a Houthi perspective, they would potentially try to escalate. I think several days ago we saw an attack on the border which left several Saudi soldiers, I think, killed, and these were the first Saudi fatalities for well over a year, because the truce that had been negotiated in spring 2022 had actually been holding quite well. So I think from a Saudi point of view, the last thing they need now is an increase in the conflict and tension on their own southern border, a renewal of the missiles and drones that were coming across, doing great damage to not just Saudi infrastructure, but to perceptions of stability in Saudi Arabia, by which the Saudis will be judged by the outside world. And so for all of these reasons, I think there'll be a lot of concern in Riyadh that the Houthis may decide, for their own domestic reasons, more so than any links that they have with Iran, that they feel they cannot just sit this one out. They have to do something, and they have to be seen to be doing something big. We obviously saw the launching of a missile towards Israel. And certainly, I think that there could be a real escalatory risk if the Houthis decide they have to really do something big, and potentially against Saudi Arabia.
Mm. And so, you know, what you're saying is that the Saudi-Iranian channel isn't enough to manage the potential threats from the Houthis in the south, and the Houthis may have their own domestic drivers for why they may want to get involved in the mix, or at least create some troubles on the front with Saudi Arabia. Now, it also mentioned the potential domestic challenges for Saudi Arabia, in the sense that if they continue to respond to Houthi attacks on Israel, they may be seen as coming to Israel's defense. And that brings me to another aspect of this, which is the domestic element in Saudi Arabia, where, you know, we've seen that the Saudis have tried to contain pro-Palestinian sentiment within their borders. You know, most Saudis naturally have an affinity for the Palestinians, and the Palestinian cause has long been supported, at least morally, by Saudis, in spite of the type of geopolitical shifts that the rulers in Saudi Arabia are attempting to perform. So we've seen, for example, the Saudi soccer team, Al Hilal, delete a Twitter post that featured one of its players wearing a Palestinian keffiyeh. Saudi journalists who had retweeted that then had to issue apologies for supposedly mixing politics with sports, and they were attacked by Twitter accounts that were aligned with the Saudi government. So talk to us about the domestic risks to MBS and regime stability in Saudi Arabia if there is a protracted conflict in Gaza between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
I think that is a very delicate situation that needs to be very finely managed, and not just for the Saudis, but for almost every other government and regime in the Middle East, where especially countries which have had established or are looking to establish ties with Israel have to very carefully manage and, in their view, control very surging displays of public anger, what they see every night on their television screens, the suffering, the death, the destruction in Gaza, and the almost overwhelming sense that this is an injustice that is being perpetuated on the Muslim world as a whole, and magnified in Saudi Arabia's case by the kingdom's own legitimization as the custodian of the two holy mosques, the sort of epicenter of Islam, and as you say, a key element of Mohammed bin Salman's opening up over the last several years has been opening up, but with very carefully controlled parameters, where you really don't inject politics into anything. And we've seen already over the last couple of years, Saudis, or young Saudis, receiving decades-long prison sentences just for tweeting or for liking and retweeting other people's tweets. I mean, there has been absolutely no room for tolerance of political views, especially on anything that could be such a trigger of political or public grievance in this way. And so the longer this conflict continues, the more angry and mobilized people get, I think the more the Saudi authorities will be very careful about trying to contain displays of public anger, and it's also what people can say about it. So I think there is a very dynamic, fluid and delicate situation. For Mohammed bin Salman, I think there's an opportunity if he plays his cards right, in the sense that the Saudis have paused normalization talks. They haven't, so far at least, said they've been suspended. They haven't pulled out, they've paused. And the Saudis are well aware that both the US and Israeli governments really do still want a deal to be reached. They really are still in favor of normalization. And so if the Saudi leadership can almost say, presumably to the Americans, to then relay to the Israelis, okay, if you want us, the Saudis, to resume negotiations, you have to do X, Y, Z on the Palestinian issue. If Mohammed bin Salman can be seen to be bringing the Palestinians to the table, securing some deal for the Palestinians that is seen to be far in excess of what other Palestinian or Arab leaders have done, that would certainly play into Mohammed bin Salman's attempt since 2020 to almost reinvent himself as a statesman, which he has tried to do, to move beyond all the missteps of his first few years when he was rising up to authority. But since 2020, we've seen him front and center in the reconciliation with Qatar. We've seen him at the front and center at Arab League meetings, even this past summer, organizing a meeting on Ukraine. So to try to present Mohammed Salman as a figure of the key regional figure who can bring the Arab world with him and secure a deal for the Palestinians, that would certainly play into that narrative and could even be very popular domestically, if it is a card the Saudis choose to play and how they play it, and if they find in Israel and the US the desire that normalization happen is enough to figure out what levels of compromise and concession they can have, albeit that the current situation, I think, is such that, especially in Israel, there's no desire at this point in time to let off.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that's a potential, I agree with you that that's a potential diplomatic opportunity down the road. But I'm wondering right now, what are we seeing from the Saudis in terms of regional diplomacy? To what extent are they a meaningful player in terms of managing this crisis? And do they even want to play a role right now? And is there some kind of behind-the-scenes role the Saudis are playing that we may not be aware of, at least in terms of the mainstream press reporting?
The initial Saudi response was actually quite interesting. It was much more hardline in the sense that the initial statement from the foreign ministry, the Saudis and the Qataris both made their initial statements that were very much also looking at the occupation and the state of the occupation as part of the problem, whereas, say, the UAE and Bahrain, which have normalized, their initial statements were much more focused on what Hamas had done. We saw the Saudis organizing and host the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, again, a more perhaps performative and reflective of Saudi's position within the Islamic world, although it did provide a very useful opportunity for the Iranian foreign minister not just to come to Saudi Arabia and to speak with his Saudi counterpart, but to speak with his counterparts from other Gulf states and other Arab states as well. So it was a very useful set of meetings, I think, that happened in Jeddah less than a week after October 7th. We've seen, I think, the Saudis at the UN very much fall in line with a consensus among the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, issuing statements in the name of the GCC, which have, again, been quite heavy-hitting in terms of criticizing Israel, for as well as Hamas, for the response, as well as the initial attacks by Hamas. So maybe working with other GCC states at the multilateral level. Obviously, the United Arab Emirates is still on the United Nations Security Council until the end of 2023, so another 2 months. And it may well be that the Saudis are working with the UAE to ensure that there's a regional voice in Security Council debates, and I suspect they probably are working together. But so far, at least, for the first 3.5 weeks, we've seen the Saudis trying to coordinate with others, and I think to try and magnify that collective voice. As this proceeds, the longer we go on, we may see the Saudis try to push for a Saudi approach, but we haven't seen that yet. And whether that would involve recommitting to the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002 or presenting an updated version of that for 2023, which is more than 20 years later, that takes into account the Abraham Accords, the new reality that Israel is no longer isolated in the region, but I don't know how that will play out. I think the Saudis will want to be seen to be part of the solution, part of a region-wide debate and dialogue. And I imagine that will be something that they will be focusing on very heavily, is the way that they can put the Palestinians front and center of whatever initiative they eventually do propose.
So let's get to Gaza itself. We've seen some pro-Israel commentators like Brett Stevens of the New York Times and others propose Saudi involvement in a peacekeeping force in Gaza if and once Hamas is dismantled. Now, let's assume that end state is possible. Do you think the Saudis would be on board? And I don't know if you've heard of this proposal before, but do you have a sense of where it may be coming from?
Well, I think the peacekeeping idea perhaps is born out of the UNIFIL in southern Lebanon, which has, I mean, I don't think the Israeli invasion of Lebanon is a very encouraging precedent to look at. And once the Israelis withdrew, there was a power vacuum, which really facilitated the emergence of Hezbollah in the 1980s. But it may well be that a peacekeeping force, multinational force, modeled on UNIFIL is what is being proposed. I think certainly the scale of destruction in Gaza is such that if and when Israel decides that they have to find a way of coexisting with Gaza and the West Bank, they cannot just simply wall them off and hope that they'll take care of themselves, because it's like a pressure cooker. The pressure just increased and increased and then exploded on October the 7th. There's got to be a way of building some sort of sustainable future that changes the calculation of incentives away from armed resistance and towards something different. And for that to happen, there will need to be huge amounts of financing for reconstruction and recovery. And a lot of that presumably will come from multinational, multilateral organizations, but a lot of it may at least the West may be looking at a lot of that come from regional states themselves. And the Saudis, the UAE, Qatar, Kuwait, they all have funds for development, which are very active. They could certainly be looked at, especially in the US, even potentially by Israel, to step in. Although you may well hear people in the Gulf saying, why should we pay for rebuilding when it's Israel or the Israeli Defense Force that has destroyed so much? But I certainly think that any response long term, once the guns fall silent and once, if Hamas has been dismantled, it is decided to figure out what happens next, I certainly think there will be, or there will have to be a regional, an Arab participation. And just by virtue of their position within the Arab world and the financial resources available to them, I suspect that the Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states will have to take part in whatever takes root.
Yeah. And so economically, you know, they've long played a role in helping developing countries in the Arab and Muslim world, countries like Egypt, countries like Pakistan, even in Central Asia, whether it's through providing aid or investment. So that's something that there's ample precedent for that. But I've seen, you know, some people propose an actual security role for the Saudis there. And there really isn't a precedent from that. And do you regard that as something that's serious?
I think the Saudi leadership would likely be very reluctant to be drawn into a security role, in part because it could be portrayed as effectively the Saudis doing Israel's security for them. And that would be, I think, very sensitive. I think it would be dangerous. I think it would risk drawing Saudi Arabia into being almost on the front line of any future recurrence of conflict. And I don't think, especially after the experience of Yemen since 2015, that is something the Saudi leadership would like to see. We may well see instead Saudi financial, logistical, administrative, and other forms of support for an Arab peacekeeping force, but without maybe Saudi participation, but sort of maybe assisting in other ways. I think maybe putting Saudi forces on the front line, as it were, would certainly be a risk, and it would be something that I don't think the leadership would volunteer, at least in the first instance.
So boots on the ground is largely untenable. Now, you know, Riyadh has taken a hard stance against Muslim Brotherhood-linked Islamist groups in the region. Hamas is among those groups. I'm wondering, how does Saudi Arabia look at Hamas today? And do they have an entity that could serve as an alternative political force there? When we look at some of Saudi Arabia's neighbors, you know, the Qataris have hosted some of Hamas's political leadership. The Emiratis have their own preferred man, at least when it comes to Palestine as a whole. Mohammed Dahlan, who's a former security chief of the Palestinian Authority. Does Saudi Arabia have any preferred actors on the ground?
Well, I don't think we see any Saudi equivalent of Mohammed Dahlan so far. I mean, Dahlan, of course, is also based in the UAE and is very close to the leadership in Abu Dhabi. And I don't, as far as I know, we do not have a Saudi equivalent among the Palestinian leadership, either within Palestine, the West Bank or Gaza, or in the diaspora. And we also do not have any equivalent of the Saudis hosting members of Hamas, as the Qataris have done with tacit U.S. support and approval. Although we did, I think, see in April or May this year, 2023, we did see a Hamas delegation go to Saudi Arabia for the first time in at least, I think, a decade. So perhaps there was the beginning of at least some form of dialogue, which may or may not have been linked to the rapprochement with Iran, I don't know. So I think the Saudis don't yet have those relationships in place. I think what the Saudis, together with many others across the region, might be looking at will be assessing how to re-empower the Palestinian Authority, which itself has its own set of issues, and Mahmoud Abbas is obviously aging and doesn't have a huge amount of his own democratic or electoral legitimacy among Palestinian populations. So they might be looking at what sort of technocratic kind of Palestinian leadership can be assembled. I mean, there were figures, Salam Fayyad, for example, Hanan Ashtawi, that could potentially be, again, I mean, Fayyad was obviously prime minister in the past. Could they be the sort of people that can put together some sort of technocratic, non-Hamas-based entity that could go forward? Again, the challenge, I think, will be that whenever the operations, the military operations in Gaza do end, you know, there's a risk that the remaining population of Gaza will be so radicalized, or at least many of them be so radicalized by what has happened, that support for resistance groups like Hamas, like Palestinian Islamic Jihad, will just have strengthened. I think that's a real risk. So I think the Saudis will be looking at how can they try to re-empower a Palestinian authority, which at least until recently had shown every sign of just fading into some form of obscurity. I think that's probably the most likely avenue to go down.
Yeah, and the sentiments of the population who are currently besieged and displaced is not really being reflected, I think, in terms of assessments, at least what we can see publicly, of a future political order there. Now, given the apparent deficit of the Saudis in terms of political contacts on the ground, do you think they will continue to work on this consensus-based approach in terms of GCC or Arab world countries, or down the road in a potential post-Hamas Gaza, there may be conflict between or competition between the Saudis and the Emiratis on securing some kind of desirable political order there?
Well, we have seen elements of competition between the Saudis and Emiratis on other issues, including Yemen, including the identity of any post-conflict Yemeni political structure. And I think both the Saudis and the UAE have their own preferred interlocutors in Yemen that rather work through. And if we saw the same in Palestine, with obviously the clear Emirati preference for Dahlan, and if the Saudis had their own different person in mind, we could definitely, I think, see an element of that competitive rivalry playing out there, I think, for the time being, and especially so long as there's no clear pathway to any political settlement, and it seems as if this military phase could last for some time, I think as long as this is the case, the Saudis will work collectively with neighboring and regional states to try and increase that collective voice. I think the Saudis would want to be front and center of any region-wide political attempt to play a role in what happens next, befitting Saudi Arabia's status in the Arab and Islamic world, and then just building on the fact that they, the Saudis, had back in 2002 led the region with the Arab Peace Initiative, and then trying to sort of lay the foundation for maybe a Saudi region-backed proposal for what comes after this.
Now, we're heading towards the end of this show, but before I ask you the final question, I just wanted to bring in the great power competition element. Now, we've seen in recent years the Saudis and the Emiratis have come closer to China in some ways from an economic and security dimension, and trying to deleverage themselves off of the U.S. And part of this is to force concessions from Washington. So how do you think this crisis affects the Saudi-China-U.S. triangle? Does it give, and you touched upon this a bit earlier, does it give Saudi Arabia more leverage with the U.S., or maybe the Saudis are coming to terms with the reality that only the U.S. can guarantee its security if the region goes up in flames? So how does this all impact that triangle between Saudi Arabia, China, and the United States?
I mean, certainly discussions with some officials in D.C. before the 7th of October had seemed to indicate that one reason the Biden administration was pushing the boat out so far to try and get Saudi Saudi deal on board was because they felt that they could offer Saudi Arabia a deal that would outmatch anything China could. And they seem to be viewing almost Saudi-Israeli normalization within the wider context, a great power competition with China. And I often thought that was just wishful thinking. The Saudis will not make a choice, like the UAE hasn't made a choice. The Saudis have made it very clear with the response to Russia-Ukraine that they do not feel that an era of great power competition, that's not their conflict, that's not their issue. If the US and China want to go head-to-head, that's their deal, but don't expect Saudi to pick sides. And I think this will continue. I think absolutely the US will defend Saudi Arabia. I think the reason why the Saudis were demanding as a prerequisite of any deal a treaty was precisely because they saw in 2019 when Abqaiq and Khurais, the oil field, were attacked by Iranian attributed groups, Donald Trump did nothing publicly. He actually distanced himself from the US and the attacks. 2 days after the attacks, Trump said this was an attack on Saudi Arabia, it wasn't an attack on the US. And that absolutely shocked Riyadh and Abu Dhabi, which is why the Saudis were trying to get the treaty built into an agreement. So I don't see the Saudis changing their position vis-a-vis the US and China. Certainly they could try and put tactical pressure on the US to move, maybe at least to exert pressure on Israel to try and move to a post-conflict situation by maybe saying, if you don't, it'll make it even more difficult at some point to reach an eventual deal. But yeah, I think I was just confused by the way that US officials seem to be thinking that they could somehow almost peel Saudi Arabia away from the Chinese orbit, because I just think if that's the animating kind of emphasis that the US is approaching this issue, then I just think they have it all wrong.
And final question, you know, this crisis is a test of the leadership of all major actors involved, including President Joe Biden, as well as MBS of Saudi Arabia. He's young, he's learning on the job, and in recent years, as you noted, he's gone from pariah to someone who's courted by investors and leaders. So how do you think he's fared so far in this crisis? How has he fared in terms of this attempted rebalancing over the past year or two? And how do you think he'll come out by the time this is all over?
Well, ironically, the campaign to isolate Vladimir Putin has actually served to rehabilitate Mohammed bin Salman in terms of his post-2018, post-Khashoggi isolation, and at least with Western leaders, that lasted up until December 2021 when Emmanuel Macron went to Saudi Arabia. But really, since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we've seen a steady stream of Western leaders, including Joe Biden, go to Saudi Arabia and re-engage with him, and also through meetings elsewhere and through telephone calls. And so I think Mohammed Salman has been very successful in moving beyond that Khashoggi Yemen kind of fog that has enveloped him, again, partly because of events. The fact that Saudi Arabia is now, in energy sense, very key once again to not just to post-Russia kind of rebalancing of energy markets, but also to debates on output and prices. We obviously saw the Biden visit to Saudi Arabia in the summer of 2022 not produce the results the US would have hoped for in terms of outputs and pricing of oil. But we see Mohammed Salman acting continuously as what he thinks is for the best of the Saudi, for his vision of Saudi Arabia. And the ultimate issue is that Mohammed Salman needs oil prices to be at a certain level to generate the revenues to pay for the vision, partly because investor confidence in Saudi Arabia collapsed after Mohammed Salman put so many of his family members and Saudi business leaders into the Ritz-Carlton just a week after the initial investment conference in 2017. You know, foreign direct investment figures collapsed after that and have still struggled to recover. So Mohammed Salman is acting in the best interest of what he thinks are the interests for himself and for Saudi Arabia, and that won't change. I think what has changed is the external context both with Russia-Ukraine and now obviously with Israel-Gaza. And actually, Mohammed Salman, the Saudi leadership, have been sounding a lot more statesmanlike over the last month than many of their peers in, well, certainly in Israel, but also I think in the US, in calling for de-escalation and trying to ensure that the conflict doesn't spread. And so that, I think, is certainly playing into that reinvention that has been underway for at least, probably at least 2 years now.
And that was Christian Ulrichsen of Rice University. We're going to be continuing with our focus on the Israeli-Palestinian crisis in our upcoming episodes. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice, and thank you for tuning in.